A question that often comes up, not just by theologians, but by average people like us, as we study the scriptures, is this question right here. Why on earth did Satan orchestrate the crucifixion of Jesus? If it was his doom, ultimately, why would he go through with it? We definitely know that Satan had his hand involved in the crucifixion of Jesus. John 13:2 says that Satan entered into Judas to betray Jesus. Luke 22:3, same thing. Satan was involved in the betrayal of Jesus and in his crucifixion subsequently. We read in Revelation chapter 12, this is difficult to decipher. I mean, it's an apocalyptic text, but it says that the dragon, Satan, the serpent of old, that part's clear, was seeking to devour Jesus even in his infancy. Well, isn't that interesting? So from the human perspective, Herod was having all of the infants under the age of 2 murdered. And yet when we get to Revelation chapter 12, we read that somehow Satan was behind this. Why is that the case? Why would Satan want to go through with the death of Jesus? Now, this isn't biblically, but cinematically. I liked this scene from Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, where Jesus is being scourged. You have the picture of the Romans and the religious leaders side by side in a crowd. And then you have this really creepy picture of Satan in the background walking through. Yeah, cinematically. Yes, from the human perspective, the Romans were carrying out the scourging, the religious leaders were inciting it, and yet behind all that, Satan was involved. Incidentally, the woman that they got to play Satan, it was a woman, but they dubbed a man's voice over Satan, which I just thought was also really cool. Anyways, the question is, why? Why would Satan go through with this? Why would he do the very thing that was fulfilling Bible prophecy, that was the apex of God's plan? Why do it? Historically, there have been different explanations as to how to answer this conundrum. The first is popular among Reformed theology, Calvinists. This is what we might call Satan the submissive. As the old reformers used to say, the devil is God's devil. So if Satan is going to do something, it's only because God is causing him to do it. He's commanding Satan to do it. This would fit underneath a Reformed perspective, namely that God is so sovereign that he is in meticulous control of all things, including Satan. And so when we read Acts 2:23, that really, you know, God had predestined this to occur, they would say, well, that's because God caused it to occur. Another perspective is Satan the sadist. So not that Satan was submissive, that he had to follow orders, but that Satan was sadistic. And this would seem to fit also. I'm not against any of these views, really. John 8:44, Satan was a murderer from the beginning. Under this perspective, Satan is so filled with bloodlust. He loves to murder. He wants to kill. He couldn't help it. The thought that now he has God embodied in human flesh, God's very son, he couldn't resist. Another perspective, there's Satan the submissive, Satan the sadist, and then Satan the Caesar. Not like Julius Caesar, but like he seizes things. Under this view, this is similar to a Roman Catholic view. Christus Victor is one of the theories of the atonement. It's very complicated, but one of the keys of this perspective is that it's thought that Satan was willing to trade all of the humans on earth in exchange for God's son. He was willing to pay that price, and he thought that he could take Jesus and keep him in hell and torture him in hell But after 3 days of being in hell, Jesus is like Neo from the Matrix and just busts free and then goes to be at the right hand of God. And so Satan thought he could keep him, but really underestimated who Jesus was, and he blew his way out of hell. It's honestly the coolest view, okay? It's just the most non-theological view. Jesus didn't go to hell to be tortured. He said it is finished. So this perspective doesn't work either. So Satan, he's submissive. He had to do it. Satan, the sadist, he couldn't help himself. Satan, the Caesar, he thought he could hold him. He couldn't. Or Satan, the surprised. This is the view that I hold to, what we call the mystery hidden. That just like all of the other people on earth, Satan didn't see this coming. Now, let's think about some Bible passages on this. Where would we get this idea? Think of 1 Corinthians 2:6. We do speak wisdom among those who are mature. Wisdom, however, not of this age, nor of the rulers of this age who are passing away. The rulers of this age. Who would that be? 2 Corinthians 4:4, this is in the second letter to the Corinthians. Paul says that Satan is the god of this world. He's the ultimate ruler of this age. Or think of Ephesians 6:12. Demons are the world rulers of this darkness. So to Paul, now if you ask Paul, are there lords and gods? Of course there are. 1 Corinthians 8, there's many so-called gods and so-called lords, whether in heaven or on earth. So he has a concept for there being earthly rulers and being demonic rulers. And yet he says in verse 7, we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God predestined before the ages to our glory, the wisdom which none, look at the absolute language, none of the rulers of this age has understood. So even if we were to say that the rulers include human rulers, Caesar, Pontius Pilate, Caiaphas, etc., this would still include the demonic rulers as well. They didn't understand. For if they had understood it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Paul seems to be saying that there was a mystery about the cross of Christ that had demons, principally Satan, known about this, they wouldn't have crucified Jesus. Think of Ephesians 3:9, the mystery for which for ages has been hidden in God. This was so secret. It wasn't revealed in Scripture. It wasn't revealed to the angels. It certainly wasn't revealed to humans. This mystery was hidden in the Godhead itself, so that the manifold wisdom of God might now be made known through the church. So whatever the mystery is, it's somehow being revealed through us to the rulers and the authorities. Where? In the heavenly places. So there's something that was hidden in God only. Only he knew this. And somehow now it's being revealed through the church to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. Demons, angels. 1 Peter 1:12. Peter says, the prophets were not serving themselves, but you in these things, which now have been announced to you through those who preach the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven. What's the context here? It's about the prophets trying to predict and trying to know about the sufferings of the Christ, and they're writing this down in the Old Testament scriptures, but they're looking ahead and like, who is this person? Who is the referent that we're writing about? He says, they didn't know. The prophets didn't know. He says, these are things that are revealed, things into which angels long to look. The predictions of Jesus weren't even fully revealed to the angels, of whom Satan is one. He himself is an angel. Now, many people will push back on this theory. It is a theory, but I think it is a theory that has the most explanatory power. It's biblical, and it really gives a fresh perspective on this subject before us tonight. Some people will push back and say, well, couldn't Satan have read the Old Testament predictions about Jesus? Think of Daniel 9. Think of Isaiah 53. Think of Isaiah 42, 49, 50, Psalm 22, Zechariah 12. I mean, Satan knew the Bible. There's a point in the Gospels where Satan is quoting the Bible. He's quoting Psalm 91 to Jesus. Satan knows his Bible. How did he not see this coming? Well, let's think about this for a second. Could the crowds see this coming? Jewish crowds, people that knew their Bibles. No, the answer is no. John 12, 34, they said, "We have heard out of the law that the Christ, the Messiah, is to remain forever." That was the Jewish construct at the time. We've got these passages about Mashiach, Messiah, and they say when he comes to earth, he's going to rule and reign forever, period. And how can you say, they ask, the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is the Son of Man? What are you talking about? Son of Man comes from Daniel 7:13, this messianic figure that's going to come and all sovereignty and power and honor and glory is given to him. And that's what we've read. And yet you're saying he must be lifted up, which is an idiom. It's idiomatic in the Gospel of John for the crucifixion. Who is the Son of Man? Why is he being lifted up? Why isn't he remaining forever? The crowds didn't know. What about John the Baptist? John the Baptist was the most righteous man on earth next to Jesus himself. How would you like to have that moniker? Jesus said, "No one is as righteous as John until now." Except, he says, believers, because we get the righteousness of Christ. Yeah, John the Baptist was unable to fully comprehend Jesus' mission. It's in that context. Matthew 11. Now people will say, well, yeah, John 1:29, "Behold, the Lamb of God who comes to take away the sin of the world." He knew something, okay? He had some kind of an insight, and yet by the time we get to Matthew chapter 11, John's writing from prison saying, "Are you the Messiah? Are you sure? If you're the Messiah, what am I doing in jail?" And Jesus has to send him, Isaiah chapter 35, that the lame walk, the deaf hear, the blind can see. Peter. Did Peter know? Well, Peter is your probably familiar. He's usually the last to know most things. At the same time, he was the first one to identify Jesus as the Christ, the Son of the living God. Think of Matthew chapter 16, Mark chapter 8. You're the Christ. You're Messiah. And yet at the Last Supper, Jesus told the disciples he was leaving. And Peter said, "Where are you going?" He's been talking. I mean, once you get to the Mount of Transfiguration in the Gospels, Matthew 17, Mark 9, Luke 9, once you get to that point, all the way forward, Jesus is constantly saying, "I'm going to be crucified, killed, handed over and tortured, and then on the third day I'll be raised again." And Jesus is like, "I'm leaving. Where are you going?" He has no idea. What about the rest of the disciples? Maybe they fared better. No. Luke 18:34, Jesus is like, "Yeah, I'm going to Jerusalem, I'm going to die, I'm going to be crucified." And the response of the disciples is this: they understood none of these things, and the meaning of this statement was hidden from them, and they did not comprehend the things that were said. That's three different ways of saying the same thing. Didn't understand, hidden, couldn't comprehend. It's not that it wasn't written. The prophecies were there, they're staring you right in the face, and yet they couldn't comprehend it, the meaning. It wasn't until Luke 24 that Jesus, quote, opened their minds to understand the scriptures. Again, the scriptures didn't change. It was their ability to see what was right in front of them the whole time. Think of those magic eye pictures. You ever seen those? Where if you kind of like cross your eyes looking at it somehow, and then you move back and forth, and then you move, and then somehow you're like, "Oh, there's a duck in that picture." And all of a sudden it pops out at you. This is the same thing here. They couldn't see it before, or the illustration, the Wheel of Fortune, where progressively different parts of the puzzle are being revealed and you can't see it. It's like staring you right in the face. And then finally that final couple letters gets flipped over and, oh, it was there the whole time, hidden in plain sight. Think about some of these passages to which we refer frequently as messianic passages. Think of Isaiah's servant songs, Isaiah 42, 49, 50, and 53. Isaiah 53, "He was pierced for our transgressions. The iniquity of us all was placed onto him." Did you know that before the time of Christ, Isaiah's servant songs, 42, 49, 50, and 53, were never, never considered to be messianic passages by Jewish interpreters. Carson and Beale write, there does not seem to be an unambiguous pre-Christian source within Judaism that identifies the suffering servant of Isaiah 53 with Messiah. Does the suffering servant ever get called Mashiach, Messiah? No. In Isaiah 42, no, he's called the servant. Isaiah 49, the servant. 50, the servant. 53, the servant. He's never called Messiah. Now that seems like a real key point that shouldn't have been left out of those passages, right? I mean, why did God leave that out? It's not that he was lying. It's just, why didn't he put in the part about him being Messiah? Under this theory, this would have incredible apologetic force. Under this theory, God didn't put all of the pieces in there so that Satan couldn't know beforehand. Afterward, when you're looking back at those passages, you can't miss it. Of course it's there. And yet before, you couldn't see it. Like all of these other humans, John the Baptist, Peter, the disciples, the crowds, the religious leaders, Satan, of course, is far more brilliant, but he wouldn't have been able to understand these predictions before. Again, let me reinforce. After the fact, it's quite clear it's referring to Jesus. Beforehand, you couldn't tell. Think about 1 Corinthians 2:14. A natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him. He cannot understand them because they're spiritually appraised. Why is it even today, showing the Bible to a non-believer, they can't understand the deep truths that are in there? Is it because there's something wrong with the Bible? No, it's because they cannot understand them because they do not understand them. There's an issue of the will. There's an issue of the heart, volitional choice, that you can't see it because you won't see it. Think of Matthew chapter 11. If you want an excellent chapter in the Bible on the mystery, Matthew chapter 11. John the Baptist can't see it. The religious leaders can't see it. And at the conclusion of this chapter, Jesus says, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and have revealed them to infants. What are the these things in that context? His messianic nature. He's explicitly saying, you've hidden these things. You can't see them. They can't see them, but you're going to reveal them to infants. Of course, we need to remember Satan isn't omniscient, nor is he omnipresent. Remember, John 14:30, Jesus says, we got to finish up soon because the ruler of this world is on his way. So while Satan knows a tremendous amount, if he has myriads upon myriads of demons working for him, I don't know what communication looks like. Do they text Satan? Do they Bluetooth phone call? Do they email? I don't know. I'm sure it's an incredibly complex communication system. And yet it falls way short of omniscience. In other words, Satan doesn't know everything. Think about the psychology of Satan. The psychology of Satan. We've been studying that Satan distrusts God at a fundamental level. That is like a fissure through his mind has become shattered. The thought of trusting God, being under God, viewing God with this caricature of who he is, that he's controlling, a distorted picture. God is sadistic. He's always holding back. He's self-serving. Why does he get to rule the universe? Why is he in charge? Why can't we all be our own deities unto ourselves? He would have never, frankly, been able to see in these passages the great and terrible solution that God took, that this wicked, evil, controlling, self-serving, sadistic tyrant God would put his own son up on the cross. Well, why? Why would he would never do that. It's impossible. Why would he do that? That just doesn't fit with the view that Satan has about God. And so why couldn't he see it in the Hebrew Scriptures? It's because he didn't want to see it. And in fact, as a consequence, what we find is that all of these accusations which Satan has leveled against God have all been defeated fundamentally, decisively at the cross of Christ. You're controlling. You're just trying to control people's lives. Well, yeah, I wanted to control everyone so much that I gave up control and let myself be murdered, tortured, hung up on a cross. Oh, you're sadistic. Oh, you're all about judgment. You surely will not die. You're just dying to bring out wrath on people. No, actually, I took the wrath that people deserve unto myself. Any sadism that was involved was them being sadistic toward me. Oh, you're self-serving. You just want to be the center of the universe. You want to be the king. You're the Lord. You get all the glory. We're supposed to glorify you. Why can't we glorify others? And how does John put it in his gospel? Whenever John is referring to Jesus being glorified, getting the glory, he's referring to the cross. Kind of gives a new perspective on God saying, I will not give my glory to another. God was ultimately glorified at the cross in the broken, bleeding body of Jesus. So controlling, no, sadistic, false, self-serving. He did the most unimaginable, unthinkable thing to sacrifice himself for distorted, aberrant, wicked sinners like us. And so this would fill in some of these questions. You know, we were studying last week. Why is it in Job that when Satan first opens up his mouth to enunciate the first syllable of his cynical, accusatory mind, why doesn't God just pull out the shotgun and blow him away? Well, he can do that. In fact, he's going to do that. Revelation chapter 20, it's a no contest fight. I mean, it's not like, you know, God and Satan are really, God shows up, Jesus shows up, and it's just like flips him over into the lake of fire. It's like when you're wrestling with your little kid brother, he's manhandling him around, lake of fire, into the abyss. No contest fight. We read in Psalm 89, verse 6, who in all of heaven can compare with the Lord? What mightiest angel is anything like the Lord? The highest angelic powers stand in awe of God. He is far more awesome than all who surround his throne. When it comes for God to judge Satan, he's just going to flick him with his finger, proverbially speaking, and judge him. So he could do that. But God chose a different method. Instead of destroying Satan, he wanted to first defeat Satan. And those are two different things. Destroying could blow him away. Defeating is eternally, that is to say, answering forever the accusations that God is self-serving, unloving, controlling, tyrannical. God, through the cross of Christ, by letting Satan rebel and then going through with his plan, has forever put to death this idea that we can't trust God. Forrester and Marsden, from their excellent book, God, Strategy, and Human History, there's actually quite a few chapters in this book that I do not agree with, but quite a few that I do. In the opening to this book, they write, we may indeed accept that God had the sheer power to stop or even destroy Satan. The problem is that in this case, even as Satan sank under God's wrath and destruction, he would have gone with a sneer on his lips as though to say, I told you so. It's well written. As soon as God pulls out the gun, blows him away, he'd be like, see, that only proves what I was saying. He's self-serving, sadistic, tyrannical. Forrester and Marsden write, such a solution would have left forever unanswered Satan's accusation that God's kingdom was based, like his own, on force and expediency. It was not a lack of power that prevented God from crushing Satan. It was a matter of principle. It is perhaps comparable to the moral restraint that makes it impossible for God to lie. It's not that he couldn't do it. It's just that in his plan, he set up rules under him, not over him, that he was allowing, his sovereignty allowed free-willed agents to rebel, and as a consequence, let them rebel, and he could do it. He chose not to. They write, Satan's accusations must be answered, and they cannot be truly answered by a force that simply crushes the accuser. Any questions? Yeah. Yeah, one of the great ironies of the book of Mark, Gospel of Mark, is that only the demons recognize Jesus as the Son of God. Until you get to the Roman centurion in chapter 15. It's kind of an interesting point. But wherever Jesus goes, repeatedly throughout Mark, particularly 1 through 8, the demons keep saying, Son of God, the Holy One of Israel, the Lord God. They recognized that he was God, or the Son of God. They recognized him as the Messiah. But their concept for that wasn't a suffering and dying Messiah. It was a conquering and judging Messiah. If you read the cross reference, it's in Luke chapter 8, verse 31, where the demon says, are you here to torment us before the time? Don't send us to the abusos, the abyss. And so their expectation was that Christ, the King, the Messiah, is going to show up. He's going to torment us. He's going to judge us. He's going to kick us out, and he's going to throw us in the abyss. Now, eventually, Jesus is going to do that. So that was their expectation, but they never saw the suffering and dying part coming. Yeah. Yeah, the difficulty in studying pre-Christian Judaism is that the sources that we have are often from much later. And so we have the Mishnah and the Talmud, and sometimes those sources contain traditions that go back to before the time of Christ, but that's very confusing. Because many of these books, the Palestinian Talmud is from 400 years after Christ. So we're trying to piece together, do these traditions which they're holding in 400 AD trace back to before the time of Jesus? Later Judaism developed the concept of two messiahs. Messiah ben David, the son of David, or Messiah ben Joseph, who is the suffering Messiah. And so you'll have references to, even as early as the 2nd century AD, my servant, the Messiah. So they started to say it's a Messiah, but a type of Messiah. But again, that's after the time of Christ. In other words, they thought maybe there's two Messiahs instead of one Messiah with two comings. Yeah. The way C.S. Lewis puts it in the Screwtape Letters is, you know, the story where one demon is mentoring and discipling a younger demon. And the older demon says, we have some of our best men with our father down below, Satan, who are working on the enigma of the cross. We know the story, the publicity, PR work of our enemy, God, that this was self-sacrificial love and he did it just because he loves. But our best men down below are still trying to figure out what was the motive behind it. Cynicism, seeing through, what was behind it. And I really like that fictional, albeit fictional, description because it gets at the core of if you have the lenses on that you can't trust God, even the cross, you can see it as our father down below, Satan, told our enemy, God, that someday he's going to figure out what was behind the cross. And the enemy said, I hope with all my heart that you do, for if you do, the war would be over. That's so cool. It won't be though, because God predicts that Satan's going to hell, so don't worry about that. Okay, yeah.